Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm net control operator of the Limark Technical Net. It's been going strong for more than 43 years now. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., sit around our radios and exchange information, educate each other, inform each other, learn from each other, hopefully entertain each other. And thanks to everyone who has returned tonight at ACF. Do it all over again. Now, let me drop for a second, and I will give you the usual link. Okay, if you want to reach me via the email, you can do that for either mailbag questions. Those questions usually asked during the technical net, but sometimes people aren't able to get to the radio. So you can email it to me if it's interesting. I might read it on the air. Also, if you have a topic either for discussion or to be part of a discussion or to listen to other people have a discussion that you just would like to request and recommend, you can email me that. If you have a TechNet puzzle, we're always looking for interesting technical puzzles. It would be nice if it would be amateur radio, but any science-related technical questions, type of puzzle would be nice to have. It's been a while since I found one. Or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to respond to a NASA space-related story, you could, of course, directly email him. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. But my email address is either, you could use either, mailbag@ac2gs.com, or you can send it to roy@limarktech.net. I have link pages of interesting articles, YouTubes, and what have you that I have collected over the last week, and I share them on a link page. They're available 24/7. You could go to them right now. You could go to them next Wednesday. You could go to them 2024, because they'll be up for a while. You can get to it by typing into your browser, roy.ac2ts.com, or links.limarktech.net. We have a chat room. It's been real quiet for a couple of months, but if you're so inclined, just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com or chat.limarktech.net, and that will land you on the chat room. I offer an audio stream of the technical net for people who just have internet access. They can type into their browser technet.ac2gs.com or stream.limarktech.net. And that will give you an audio stream of the Glen Oaks repeater. I keep it live all week long. And, of course, I want to remind people that MikeAC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv, and it's had over 1 million visitors. And it is the repository for archives of the Limark Technical Net that go as far back as September of 2006. So please check in on it and listen to a couple of oldies but goodies. There's a lot of wisdom from many people who have either moved away from the area or unfortunately become silent keys. So we miss them, but they live on in the archives. Let me drop for a second and I'll tell you what we got planned. We have a pretty much standard night tonight. I will ask if anyone has any questions or topics or comments for the technical net. You don't have to check in, just say hello. Hopefully I can sense you all out there in the force. I would prefer amateur radio-related comments, questions, and topics, at least at first. As time goes on, we'll open it up to anything science, technology-related. As you all know, I'm fine with discussing any of that. That should take us approximately to 10:15. Paul will come with the SpaceNet report, and that will take us to about 11 p.m., and I will return to tie a bow on it and wish you well for not only the next week, but the rest of 2023, because this is going to be our final technical net tonight for 2023. Next week is Christmas Eve, and the Sunday after is New Year's Eve, and I'm sure you guys have better things to do than listen to me. So this will be our last one for 2023, but no fears. We will return January 7th for 2024. So with all that in mind, let me drop and ask if anyone has any questions or comments or topics or discussion tonight. To hit that push to talk, give me your first name, your call sign, and what you got for tonight.
KC2, Mike Delta Papa, Steve, and yes.
KB2VHD, Jim, with traffic. Good stuff, I think.
Steve and Jim recognize. Anyone else want to put your name down on the list for tonight?
AC2PL with questions.
Jeff recognized. Anyone else want to put their name down? There'll be time later, but it's always good to put your name down early so you have a sense of when your turn will come. Okay. I'm sure there'll be a few more as time goes on. Well, Steve, you're up first. What do you got for us?
Okay, very good. Thank you. Thank you. Good evening to everyone out there tonight. I have a, I'm working on a 71-foot end-fed antenna. It's an inverted L configuration. I have, let's see, 50 feet of counterpoise. I have about 50 feet of LMR-400 coax going into an RF choke. And I'm just trying to get the SWR down. I mean, I can get it down on certain bands, messing with the counterpoise. I can get it down to on different bands, as a matter of fact, messing with the coax length and placement of that RF choke. I've looked on, you know, YouTube and internet and everything else. And some of them say ground the counterpoise. Other ones say let the counterpoise float. Put the counterpoise on the ground, keep the counterpoise in the air. Also, you don't even need a counterpoise if you're running the 50 foot coax. What I actually like to do is use the counterpoise and shorten the coax. Just any thoughts on, you know, what I should do here, any tips, tricks, anything like that to get the SWR a little bit lower on this thing. You know, some of the bands is about 3 to 5, other ones are 5, 6, 7, you know, once, well, you know, like I said, mess it with the counterpoise, you know, I'll get 20 good, 40 you'll see. Then I'll mess with the counterpoise, I'll get 40, I'll get 10 good. You know, it's just up and down different bands, just messing with the counterpoise. Like I said, I even tried messing with the coax, but not so much. So any help you can give me, I'd greatly appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, Steve. Yeah, N-feds are fascinating things. Your N-fed, I would assume, is a non-resonant version. They come in two types. They come as half-wave resonant versions and non-half-wave non-resonant versions. So which one would you describe yours as?
This one's definitely non-resonant. It's 71 foot. I do have a MFJ, it's resonant N-fed. I use portables when I go camping, but I think it's like 135 feet long. And you got to use the antenna, but the SWR is, you know, at worst, maybe 2, 2.5.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I tend to find that resonant N-feds behave a little bit better most of the time. I did an article for the Limark log. I kind of got screwed up, unfortunately, but that showed antenna simulations of what goes on resonant half-wave N-feds. You know, I mean, you really shouldn't need counterpoise and a radiating, unchoked coax cable. If you don't have a counterpoise, it's never a good idea to choke the transmission line at the antenna feed because the laws of physics tend to require some amount of counterpoise activity, and by RF choking it at the feed point, you don't give it much to work on. It's like having half of a seesaw. But if you have a counterpoise, that should be sufficient. And unfortunately, different people find that doing different things with the counterpoise are beneficial. It sort of depends upon the design, topology, environment that you're putting it, height that you're putting it. Higher is always better than lower. If you couple too much to the ground, you're going to have resonant problems no matter what you put the counterpoise as. So I would not do away with the counterpoise. I would choke the transmission line, a couple feet away, maybe from the antenna feed, and you just have to unfortunately experiment with the counterpoise of what it works for you. And as you've noticed, it's probably not going to be one position fits all. There'll probably be optimal length and elevation that work for some bands and not for others. So I wish I could tell you that all you have to do is ground the thing and it'll work perfectly, but I've never really read where that's the case. It's you got to kind of go with the flow with those things. You know, when they work, they're very good, so when they don't work, they're very frustrating.
Okay, very good. Yeah, you gave me some definite info there. I might try raising it up a little bit. What I do have, you tell me if this would affect it. Originally, I was going to put up one of those all-band Hustler quarter-wave jobbies on this pole, and I ended up going with the 71-foot N-Fed because, like I said, I had the MSJ one. I use portable, and that seems to work real great, and, you know, you got pretty much everything from 80 on up. What I have is about, I'd say maybe 25 feet of metal mat, and then I got about 4 or 5 feet of PVC, and then I have a pulley there that goes to the rope, which basically, you know, holds the thing probably about 2 or 3 feet off that metal pole. It goes up into a tree to another pulley and then drops straight down, and it's about 3 to 4 feet off the ground. As far as the counterpoise, right now I have it 50 feet, and it goes down the pole. It's actually taped to the metal pole, and it's coiled up on the ground in about maybe an 8-inch coil. And that seems to give you the best SWR so far. It's not great, like I said, 3.5. I think 80 meters is forgetting, like through the roof, it's like 6 on that. But I've heard that 80 meters can be a problem. You got some of the coil at the end of it or something like that. I'm not too worried about that. But I'm just trying to get the SWR down as, low as I can to keep the antenna 2.5. Any idea of what a random SWR across the band should be on something like this?
Well, yeah, I've seen VNA sweeps where it goes every which way. Occasionally, if you got something that's well behaving, some of the bands actually dip down and give you decent. But depending upon the length and what's going on, the one thing you didn't mention, which I'm a little curious about, I assume, of course, that you have something like a 9-to-1 balance at some point in there.
Yes, definitely, yeah. I think it's Palomar or something makes it. It's like a 2 PVC forming end caps. They call it the bullet or something. Definitely have that, yes.
Okay, that's a 9-to-1 impedance transforming balance?
9-to-1, yes.
Oh, okay. Well, like I said, unfortunately, it's very difficult to get to those low bands because usually these NFEDs kind of work at their half-wave equivalent and shorter. So you're nowhere near 80 meters for it. So it would be very difficult to do. You could play games and have the counterpoise loaded with loading coils. It would be very inefficient. There'd be a lot of ground coupling. So you might get away with an impedance of roughly 50, 60 ohms, but the amount of energy that would probably be radiated out into the sky would be inconsequential. So as you suggested, I don't think it's worth the trouble to try and get 80 meters off of something like that. So it's just a matter of playing around with the counterpoise. Sometimes they work better if they're a little shorter for the higher frequencies. And if you find that coiling it so there's some additional inductance, if that works for you, then fine, go with it. I wish I could give you kind of a magic word to make it all work great, but NFEDs, especially non-resident NFEDs, each are different creatures, and you have to learn their likes and dislikes and to act accordingly. If anyone else has any good suggestions, though, we're open to other people's opinions out there. So if you're out there and you've done work with non-resident NFEDs and you'd like to add to the discussion, please feel free.
KD2VHD, Jim?
Yes, Jim.
As luck would have it, this question relates to my question last week, and then it's kind of a question I have to ask later on. And it goes back to a very important point that I seem to have learned recently, and I still am trying to grasp the whole understanding of it. But that coax cable is a three-conductor cable at RF frequencies, and that outside of the coax does all sorts of interesting things that can be beneficial or not beneficial in this case and in the cases that I'm going to bring up later. And it can be the counterpoise, or it could be the source of all sorts of kinds of trouble. And if you're not considering that in the antenna design, you're missing a very important point.
Yeah, I agree with you, Jim. I kind of touched on that earlier, that sometimes people don't put a counterpoise on their NFED, and at least will choke it down a length of coax cable. Once you effectively RF choke a coax cable, the common mode current should be attenuated a great deal, and that'll limit the length that the transmission line is acting as a counterpoise. But in Steve's case, he already has a reasonably decent counterpoise fully realized. So it sort of complicates and gets redundant if he has a counterpoise, then he has a transmission line that's sort of acting like a counterpoise. They can interfere with each other. They can benefit each other sometimes, but they can also interfere with each other. And that's why I suggested that if when he applies the RF choke to the transmission line, he doesn't necessarily have to put it straight up to the feed line, but relatively close to the feed line, so that the primary counterpoise is going to be the piece of wire that he's using for that purpose, rather than his transmission line that's kind of being shanghaied into that duty.
It's an interesting topic. I'm glad it's being discussed. It's right in the chapter that I'm trying to figure out.
Okay, very good. Maybe we can get some other people's opinion. Once again, I am AC2GS. This is the Landmark Technical Net, and we all learn from each other. So if there's someone out there with expertise in non-resident NFEDs, and they'd like to share some insights with us, and especially with Steve and Jim, then please hit that push to talk. I guess everyone's starting the holiday season somewhat early. So, Steve, anything else? Wesley, you wanted to say something?
I just anticipated you. Are you asking for participation?
Well, no, that was about 10 minutes ago, but I'll pencil you in. Right now, Steve is asking about non-resident NSAIDs. He has one. He's trying to get it to tune it more than a few bands at a time. Something strange seems to be going on with the repeater. I don't exactly know what. But thankfully, I can go through it, whatever it is. So, Steve, I'm afraid that there's no takers for second and third and fourth opinions out there. At least not tonight.
That's no problem. So you're suggesting also that maybe rather just what the you know, I think Palomar makes this thing. They suggest putting the Aura choke end of the 50-foot length of coax. So you're saying maybe I should try coming off the Yana on maybe 3 or 4 6-meter coax, let's say, and then running my length of coax to the radio. And do you think I should ground that coax that does say, you know, where it comes into the house, let's say talking?
Well, yeah, I mean, you could ground it. It shouldn't really have much of an effect if you appropriately common mode choked it. I could see that instruction if they didn't suggest or recommend having a separate countercoise. As long as you have a decent counterpoise, it's somewhat too much of a good thing, in my humble opinion. And again, although if you're real lucky, the two might improve it, it's just as equally possible that two counterpoises in different directions are going to interfere with each other's function. So I would simplify the model by choking it, as you mentioned, a couple of feet away from the B-point. Make sure that your counterpoise is doing well. You might want to try it ungrounded and grounded just to see if it really benefits you. It sort of depends what you're grounding it on. If you're just kind of doing it on a pipe, that's decent. If you're just kind of doing it in the ground, it depends what kind of ground you have. If you're near the beach, sandy ground is very good. Granite is terrible. So all these variables, unfortunately, factor into how these things will operate.
All right, very good. Yeah, it gives me something to experiment with. Yeah, I'll try several different methods. Yeah, I'll try putting that choke up up near the Yana, and I'll even try without it. You know, I'll try moving the counterpoise again. I'll just have to play around like I've been doing. I greatly appreciate the info, though. You know, like I said, it's a challenge, that's for sure.
Yeah, and some people enjoy challenges. I limit my challenges to things that are worth my time. I would recommend that at some point or another you do have the RF choke on your transmission line, because one of the downsides of NSAIDs is they are notorious for common mode RF getting into your shack. And your computer and your radio are probably not going to like that. So if you want to experiment with not choking the RF a few feet away from the feed line. At least choke it before it gets anywhere near your shack, just for the sake of your electrical equipment.
Hey,
yeah, well, yeah, well, what I've been doing is using the MFJ antenna analyzer so far. To this point, it hasn't even been hooked to the radio yet. I'm just trying to play with it through the antenna analyzer.
Oh, okay. I mean, that's very useful. It's it's a great time to be a ham. VNAs are relatively cheap. 20 years ago, I remember Dick discussing that a good VNA would cost you $20,000-$30,000. So I know of no ham that would have spent that much of money. They might have kind of sneaked it out of their job, but they certainly wouldn't buy it. So I wish you good luck, Steve. Jeff, AC2PL, I think I heard you. Do you have any comments about this?
AC2PL, thanks, Roy. Yeah, I just actually had the opportunity to kind of revisit a friend's antenna setup. I made an antenna for a buddy of mine, and I wrapped a 9-to-1. I had wrapped a 9-to-1 for him at some point. He put a lot of power through it, and it shorted from the wire straight to the ferrite, and that one had some impressive arcing. This time I sheathed it with Teflon, and it was the same thing, a standard 9-to-1, and we ran 100 feet of wire, roughly 100 feet of wire. But, going back and looking how we installed it, it comes out of his house coax to a 1-to-1, straight into the 9-to-1. Off the 9-to-1, we ran two different lengths of counterpoise. I can't remember the lengths, but they went in opposite directions, lying directly on the ground. And then the wire went straight up the house, right along the siding, and then we ran it from a suspension point out directly through an apple tree, and then eventually out to a point where we were able to pull it up with a pulley into a tree and then dangle about 20 feet until it came down to about 10 feet off the ground. And this is really, it's shoehorning an antenna into a space. But I got to be honest with you, he's tuned it up to probably 1,000 watts and worked the world with that antenna in the configuration, the suboptimal configuration. So I would recommend just take it off the VNA and start testing it on the air. QSL.
Yeah, that's very good advice. Yeah, it's always nice to have a perfectly resonant antenna, but if you don't, then that's why God created antenna tuners or impedance matching devices, whatever you want to call them. It doesn't impair. It does kind of provoke a little bit of a loss. None of them are designed loss-free, but it allows you to tune. And you might not need 100% efficiency. You might be able to settle for 20 or 30 or 40%. So I agree with you. If even if the VNA kind of disappoints a little bit, get yourself a very good antenna tuner. I have PALSTARS myself. I really like them. They use L impedance transforming circuitry as opposed to most of the newer, smaller, less expensive tend to use, I think, T-circuit impedance matchings, which doesn't quite get you the range that an L does. So, anyway, I agree with you on that. And I wish you good luck, Steve, and come back and tell us how it worked out.
Oh, that I definitely will. Yeah, it gives me something to play with, which is kind of fun. The weather's been nice, so, I'll go out over the holiday weekend there and see if I can get this thing to match a little bit better. And one way or the other, I'll come back and let you guys know how I made out. Thank you again for all the info.
Okay. You're welcome, Steve. Next on our list for tonight is Jim, KD2VHC. What do you got for it? You kind of gave us a hint. of part of what you have for us tonight. So would you like to expand upon that?
Hey, good evening, Roy. Last week I was speaking about the idea of the flower pot, so-called, or the vertical. There's a couple different names for it. Bazooka or collinear dipole, and a couple different names. Basically, the gist of it being something taking advantage of the third conductor on the coax, the outer skin, and using that as the counterpoise, the other half of the dipole. And I realized I have the ability to put up like a flag halyard up at a couple trees. I can probably get 65, 75 feet up. And the ability to haul up any old antenna I want vertically very easily, you know, in moments, pull it up, pull it down. And I was considering these concepts about the skin effect and using the outer skin of the coax as the other side of the antenna. And I thought to myself, what if I had a chalk reel type thing, which is often used for end-fed variable antennas, with a bare copper conductor, and I could vary it from 2 meters to 10 meters to 20 meters to 15 meters to 12 meters, and where the shield stopped down to a choke, which I understand Palomar sells, you can get like a stack of beads from 5 to 10 to 15 beads, so you have lots of common motor beads. So if I could vary the length of the positive side of the antenna connected to the set of core to coax, and I could slide the inductor, the choke up and down, I could lower the antenna on the halyard, raise or lower the radiating element, and slide the choke to match, and I could make any one of any antennas in moments. Am I crazy, or does this concept make any sense?
It makes some sense. It's most people would kind of go a little crazy maneuvering it. It's not a very easy to switch out, because you have to kind of lower it, and you have to deal with snap-ons, and the more that you use them, the faster they kind of age. You're kind of designing a manual stepper antenna. Stepper antennas fascinate me. We've talked in the past about them, and one person... No, I haven't bumped into anyone who actually has spent the thousands of dollars that some of the more expensive versions cost on the technical nets or on radio in general. He had a friend who had a stepper, and didn't seem to be that keen to it, because it had a lot of features that were breakable. But it's basically a stepper motor based coil of wire that rolls in and rolls out to be resonant. So you're kind of trying to do it manually, with the additional headache of having to also adjust a bunch of RF chokes so that you have the second leg of a dipole in common mode. So I guess it's possible. I don't know how easily it can be done, and how many times after you do it repeatedly things start to fail.
Good point, Paul. And while I'm electrically retarded, rigging I can do. And I wasn't talking about snap-on chokes. I was talking about slide-on ferrites, a stack of maybe 10 or 15 of them, which you can buy for 20, 25, 30 bucks. They sell it as a kit with a string tubing. You just slide it to where you want it and put a piece of tape on it. But the rigging, I got that. I can rig anything with ropes. I can do magic with ropes. Electrically, the concepts are new to me, and I'm trying to absorb what it really means. So to change this device from, let's say, 10 meters to 20 meters, piece of cake, within the height limitations that I have, which I think I can do maybe 65, 70 feet. But electrically, I'm still like, could that really work? It sounds intriguing.
Yeah, I think in principle it could work, but again, I have done what you suggested with the toroid. Well, with I use snap-ons. You could use non-snap-ons. The only problem with that is you have to insert them in around your transmission line before you put the connectors on them. Otherwise, they'll be way too loose. The problem is that usually those are stationary by design. You usually want to use the shrink tubing longer than the row of ferrite so that at either end they pinch up the transmission line and fix them in position. Because if you don't do that, then you're going to have to come up with some mechanical means to stabilize them. I guess you could put clamps on them on the bottom, and that would kind of limit their play. Probably you'd have to put a clamp above in case, you know, wind and the transmission line moving around in the wind would cause them to kind of bounce up and down and such. So it's interesting. I don't think I've ever seen it in the literature. It certainly would be interesting to hear how it turned out. I tend to see a lot of mechanical problems and fatigue problems arising after a while, but it'll be certainly an interesting experiment.
Well, like I said, the mechanical issues I can solve. That's easy. And one of the biggest things I've come to understand, and I'm firmly a believer in this, the number one failure point of an antenna is the coax connector at the base of the antenna where the feed line. And I intend, as much as possible, to eliminate that entirely. And this potential design eliminates that entirely. There is no connector. The coax becomes the antenna. The stack of beads would be slid over the coax and the antenna. And you could, a zip tie would open. Be all you need. There's other ways I could do it that would be simpler but harder to explain. But a zip tie, you could snap it off and slide it anywhere you want. The mechanical part of it, I got down. That's cake. The electrical part of it, I'm like, is it really this simple? That's my big question.
Well, again, in principle, yeah, it is. I mean, there's a bunch of antennas designed on that basis, and reportedly they're doing what they're supposed to do. So it's just a matter of getting the length right for what you have planned. You can use that method to stabilize the ferrite. Probably more repeatable. It's true, they're cheap. Those little plastic things. You might want to consider just the little gaskets that the people kind of secure tubing with. As a means that you could loosen the screw and shimmy it down and change the length so that you could use the same equipment repeatedly for, you know, I don't know how many times, but a lot more repeatedly than those other fasteners you mentioned earlier. So, I think in principle it's not so bizarre, it's not fantasy. It'll be interesting to see what kind of mechanical problems you need to address, but it's certainly worth the effort, in my humble opinion.
Well, thank you for the feedback. Like I said, I have mastery of the mechanical. Electrical, I welcome the feedback. Anybody else have any thoughts on the idea? Then I'll go on to the second part of my question, if that's okay.
Sure. Feel free.
So we all know that your output from your radio is a 50-ohm coax connector, and we all know that your coax that goes off from that is 50 ohm cable. We all know that adapting it to 300 ohms or something, 75 ohms, the various things takes a balance. And we all know that you're supposed to match the impedance of your radio to the cable, to the antenna. But my question is, why? I don't get that. Why? And, like, for example, if in electric, not electronics, not RF, but electric, the transmission cable, as long as its resistance doesn't impede your electrons from getting where they want to go, it don't care. So I'm confused, and I hope somebody could paint a picture about this, of why it is that the impedance needs to match, whereas if it was less impedance, the electrons could get to where you want them to go easier, and it would be no problem. I'm missing some part of that puzzle. Can anybody fill that picture in?
Okay, let me try, and if someone else has a better analogy, we'll give them an opportunity. Instead of using the impedance of transmission lines, let's kind of veer a little bit away. Optical density, the apparent speed that light travels through transparent objects, is actually the same phenomenon. Glass and all transparent objects have an impedance. We call it optical density. Different objects have different optical densities. Diamonds have the greatest optical density, and that's why they refract and reflect so much light and give the diamond the sparkle they do. So you're standing in front of a store window. The air in front of you has a certain impedance, a certain optical density. The glass pane has a different optical density. When you're looking through the window, you'll notice your own reflection. Part of your signal is not going through the window. It's getting reflected back at you. The same thing happens in transmission lines on the RF range.
I got the analogies, and I understand, like, when you look into a lake and you see a fish, he's not where you see him. He's at an angle different than that. But I'm not connecting it to the electrical quite readily.
I wasn't alluding to refraction, which is the quality that shifts the apparent position of objects with a different optical density. I was just commenting upon that objects that transmissions when they reach differing impedances will reflect the percentage of their signal back at you with an obvious loss. If it's reflected, it's not going through. So if you can match the optical density of, you know, there are loads of YouTubes and such where people will submerge a transparent object. You can see the object in air, but when they put it into fluid, because the fluid has the same optical density as the object, it becomes invisible and light goes right through it. So the bottom line is, there's a few things going on. One is that when the transmission line reaches a different impedance, a percentage is reflected back, and that's lost. So depending upon the mismatch, 2-to-1, 3-to-1, 4-to-1, 5-to-1, 6-to-1, a greater and greater percentage of that signal is reflected back. And just generally, way back, Andy, WA2CDL, may rest in peace, gave a little talk that energy, the most efficient transfer of energy is done when all of the generator, the transmission line, and the load all have the same impedance. So it's different with DC because DC doesn't really have an impedance. It doesn't act like that. So the problem is that we're dealing not with direct current, but with radio frequencies and such, which have impedances and reflections and what have you. So you could either think of it one way or the other, at least in my head, as the inherent reflection from discontinuous, non-constant impedances, or the simple rule that the maximum transfer of energy takes place when all the parts of the circuit have the same inherent impedance, whatever works for you.
Well, I appreciate the effort, and I'm still stuck on something. It's a little bit like, you know, the law of gravity says things fall at a certain rate, but what gravity is, we have no idea, really. The fact that this does that, can we explain why it does that? Why it travels more efficiently through a matched impedance? That's the thing I'm trying to get at. And maybe I'm looking for something that doesn't exist, but I'm guessing it does. And the fact that you get that reflected signal, why is the impedance the thing that creates that reflection? Maybe I'm starting to get there, but it's still a reach for me. And sorry if it's
with a kind of
simplistic for some folks.
I can try one if you want there, Roy, WYW.
Yes, please do. By the way, Chris recognized. We'll get to you in a minute.
Okay, Roy, this is Mike, WY2U. Well, I'm going to try to introduce the topic of standing waves and how they behave in a match system and in an in-match system, a mismatch system. If you have a situation where everything is matched, the transmission line, let's say, is equal to 50 ohms, the source, the transmitter, is designed to operate with best efficiency into 50 ohms, and if the load impedance on the other end of the transmission line is also 50 ohms, a very interesting thing happens. The voltage coming out of the transmitter, the voltage measured anywhere along the transmission line, and the voltage at the load are all equal. The same goes true with the current. In other words, no matter where you look on that line, no matter how long it is, I'm assuming the line is lossless, the voltage and current are constant along the line. All the energy that gets sent out of the transmitter then, without interaction, gets delivered to the load, and the load efficiently either dissipates it as heat if it's a resistor, or radiates it away into space if it's an antenna system. Let me drop a minute. Now, if the condition is such where the load impedance does not match the impedance of the transmission line, the load reacts by reflecting a portion of the voltage back the other way towards the transmission line, which could be, depending on what the impedance of the load is, reinforcing or being destructive in interference, and it may or may not be in phase. So what happens then is this reverse traveling wave of voltage adds or subtracts from the incident voltage coming out of the transmitter. And if you were to try to measure the voltages and currents along the line, you will find out that they're not equal anymore. In fact, the ratio of the maximum voltage to the minimum voltage on the transmission line, provided it's long enough, is actually called standing wave ratio, VSWR. Now, Thevenin equivalent circuit says that to get maximum power transfer from source to load, the load impedance should equal the source impedance. Or, in the case of a system that contains both resistance and reactance, maximum power occurs when the load is the conjugate of the source, which means if the source is resistive and inductive, to get maximum power transfer, the load should be the same value of resistance and capacity. Does that make sense so far? Can I just drop a minute, Roy, give it back to you? WY to you.
Yeah, Mike, it makes perfect sense.
Running into something that I can't go on.
Yeah, I'm sorry if I interrupted you, Jim. Mike, I agree with you. I understand, and obviously what you're saying is correct. The only problem is if you take it into the weeds so much that you can successfully explain why impedance mismatches produce reflected waves, I think we get into EE land where people are not very happy playing.
I think therein lies the problem. The fact that the voltages are no longer equal between the load, the source, and places on the transmission line is what gives people trouble. If the voltages were all equal, there'd be no standing waves, and therefore the system would be 100% efficient. But once you set up a situation where the load no longer matches the impedance of the medium, in this case the transmission line, the voltages can no longer be equal. And once they can no longer be equal, you must have a situation where maximum power cannot occur. Some power will get dissipated or radiated by the load, for sure, but a portion of that power cannot be dissipated or radiated. Therefore, it has to flow back the other way towards the transmission line and back to the source. I don't know of any other easier way to explain it. It's due to the fact that the voltages and currents on the line are no longer equal. Back to that.
KC2MVP. Yes, MVP. There is an interesting video on YouTube I watched several years ago. It's called Standing Up for Standing Waves. It's like an hour and a half long, I do believe, and this guy does a pretty good job of explaining it.
KD2WOT.
Yes, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, along the lines, I would like to recommend another video. It's a very old video, and it was produced by AT&T Bell Labs. And it's entitled Similarities of Wave Behavior. And it really does help to clear up these things as wave behavior is demonstrated mechanically. And I believe that would be very helpful.
DDA for the comments. Would you like to you?
Yeah, two people doubled. I think one was John.
Yes. Yeah, yes, I highly would recommend that video at the ATT Tech Channel by Dr. Shive, Similarities in Wave Behavior. It's a beautiful mechanical analogy of the whole behavior of reflection, standing waves, forward waves, reflected waves. It is a beautiful mechanical analogy of everything that happens on the transmission line. It's a really a beautiful video. Like you say, it was done back in the late 50s, but it is an incredibly beautiful video to watch.
Okay, thanks. There was another person who doubled with you. If you want to throw out your call.
Yeah, Roy, this is Mike WY2U. I just wanted to point out that coming up HRU 2024, I actually am going to be giving a forum on this exact topic, BSWR, power flow, and reflections, transmitter efficiency, Thevenin equivalent circuits, the whole thing. So anybody who is interested, that forum will take place. I think I have the 10 o'clock slot, 10 o'clock to 11. Room 3, it's HRU 2024. Go ahead.
Okay, hopefully they'll record it and make it available on YouTube. That would be a very valuable resource.
I'm not sure if they're going to be having recordings or not, but again, anybody attending HRU 2024 and has that slot open, if you're interested in the subject, please do. And it's a PowerPoint presentation, a little bit of math, not really heavy math, but what is going to be required is when the math gets a little bit elegant, I have a spreadsheet that does the tough calculations and you can see the results graphically. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. I mean, my problem, again, I agree with everything you said. It's just... none of this, you might be able to demonstrate on models reflections, but the problem of reducing the explanation why impedance mismatches produce wave reflections without using math and you know, somewhat more sophisticated concepts in electronics, I don't know if it's possible to do that.
Well, you know, I might try something else if I could there, Roy. If you want to consider throwing a stone in a very placid lake and making ripples and waves. If the waves, let's say the lake had no inherent loss and everything was just pure distilled water and water was completely lossless, if you drop a stone, throw a stone in a lake, the ripples will travel and travel and travel ad infinitum, spread out and go out to infinity. And they'd be more or less equal in length, height that is, and the separation between the wavelets would be constant, whatever they are depending on what the density of the water is. Now the problem is, what happens when these ripples get to the other side of the lake and they start to impinge on dry land again? Consider that the lake has a certain medium. It's got a certain density, as you pointed out before, it has a certain temperature, and its propagation of the wave is a function of what the material of the water is made of, and water is water. When the wave hits the shore, all of a sudden you have a different medium. All of a sudden now the waves can no longer be constant. They have to change in amplitude. Some of them are going to get absorbed as energy, mechanical energy in the shoreline. But what can't be absorbed as energy is going to be reflected back and add or subtract to the waves that were generated by the fact that the stone was being thrown. There's a mechanical analogy right there. And really what it means is standing waves don't exist provided that the medium is constant. If the medium is 50 ohms and the antenna is 50 ohms, well, that's a constant medium. If the transmission line is 50 ohms and the antenna is not, it's kind of like waves from a water on the lake hitting the shore. It's a poor analogy, but maybe it makes the point. WY2U.
Okay, I mean, I'll pass it back to Jim and find out. You know, some analogies work for some people. I found an interesting analogy for the fact that momentum and position of electrons can't simultaneously be experimentally found by using an analogy to radar waves and the the duration of the radar ping back in the good old days with Dick. And since he was a radar guy, among other things, he liked that. So analogies kind of work for some people, not for others. I don't know. I tend to prefer the optical analogy because the optical analogy is almost identical to the RF analogy. Because optical light is just a high-frequency RF. And transmission lines and optical densities are the same thing. So the closest the analogy is to the actual case, the better for me personally, but I could understand why others might not feel that way. So let me ask Jim if Mike's analogy helped you.
Well, you're going to swear I was up to something when I started this, and I promise you I was not. I really, my question was absolutely from, I don't get this, and I think now I get it, and you're going to laugh from your belly when you hear what my analogy is.
Okay, let it rip.
So I think we're talking about a plunger here. When you use a plunger, that solves certain drastic problems. If you don't get the frequency of the period of the wave, the signal doesn't go down the pipe, and it certainly doesn't go down the pipe efficiently. But if you get the impulse right, the voltage right, and the period of the wave right, it flows down the pipe with great efficiency. I think that's the analogy I've been looking for, and I think that covers the topic, as grotesque it is. And SWR is the score back you get of the not pleasant stuff when you foul up the match. I think I got it now. And I swear to you, I did not... I came to that listening to this discussion. I did not have that in my mind beforehand. I think I get it. And chuckle as you will, but I think that's the analogy that works.
AC2GS. It's fine, Jim. Whatever analogy works for you. The problem is analogies by almost definition are not the actual situation. They're similar somewhat. So they help in establishing a better understanding, but when you take them down to the infinitesimal, they take